Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Twitter appears to have put Facebook to shame last week. Unlike Facebook's public rollout, Twitter's initial public offering saw its stock jump 73% in just a matter of hours, the biggest one-day show for an IPO in 6 years. Joining us to talk about that is Peter Delavitt. He's a tech reporter for the San Jose Mercury News, where they pay very close attention to such things. Welcome to the show, Peter.
Good morning, Ann.
So, What do you make of the Twitter IPO? Is it time and circumstance? Is it Twitter's a better product, even though it hasn't shown a profit? What is the overall explanation for what happened last week?
Well, Twitter came out at a time that Wall Street has been pretty receptive to tech IPOs. After Facebook came out last year and face planted, there was about a two-month period where there were no tech IPOs at all. And then one or two started coming out, and this year we've had a pretty good run. The thing that is different, though, is that all of those tend to be enterprise software companies. So companies like Marketo, for instance, which makes marketing automation software, which is not something that you or I are likely to use in our everyday lives. But Wall Street has been really receptive to companies like that. Well, this sets Twitter apart. So they came out at a time where there was a lot of enthusiasm, but there had not been really any consumer internet companies to kind of test Wall Street's enthusiasm. So I think partly it was market timing. They were coming out at a time when Wall Street has really shown a lot of appetite for tech stocks. And also, I think Twitter is a brand that a lot of people know. You know, a lot of the companies that have been coming out aren't ones that people necessarily have heard of. And I think even if you don't use Twitter, and obviously 200 million people do every month, you've probably heard of it. Your friends have used it, maybe. So I think that always, or not always, but can often help a stock to gain some momentum just with a retail investor.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Peter Delavitt of the San Jose Mercury News about the Twitter IPO last week. If you have a question or comment, you can join the conversation, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Peter, it's not like Facebook wasn't well known either. How Wall Street has more of an appetite. Why more of an appetite? And how do we compare and contrast what happened with Twitter to Facebook?
Well, one of the things that really, really kneecapped Facebook's IPO was that the NASDAQ, which is the exchange on which Facebook made its debut and is traded, had a software meltdown the morning of the IPO. The CEO of the NASDAQ told me in an interview last year that the IPO software had never been tested with with that high a level of demand. There were so many people who wanted to buy Facebook at the IPO that their software crashed. It took about 20 or 30 minutes to get it back up. And then after it came back, actually, they had to switch it to a backup system. That backup system for Facebook was not able then to automatically match buyers and sellers to their orders. So there was a lot of chaos at the NASDAQ a year and a half ago when Facebook came out. A lot of those orders had to be matched manually. So that was really one of the big factors that once Facebook, they came out, they went up slightly, and then they started dropping. And there was a lot of frustration and confusion that morning. Not to say that that was the only reason that Facebook didn't do well. Facebook also did some other things that Twitter didn't do. And Dick Costolo, the CEO of Twitter, reportedly was very, very conscious, he and his board, about doing things differently than Facebook had done. For instance, Twitter trades on the New York Stock Exchange, not the NASDAQ. Some other things, Facebook in the days up before its IPO, they had so much demand, they not only increased the price of the shares that they were selling, but they also increased the number of shares that they were selling. And I think in retrospect, that probably had this sort of classic supply-demand. You raise the price, and maybe that hurts demand a little bit, then you increase the number that you're selling, that increases the supply. Twitter did also come out in the face of high demand from institutional investors right before the IPO, mm-hmm. and increased the price that they were selling, but they did not share any more they did not sell any more shares. They kept that supply fairly limited. So that's another reason that Twitter they just, you know, they were able to, I think, learn in a lot of ways from Facebook's mistakes and do some things differently than Facebook's bankers and Facebook's CFO had done. And again, they came out at a time. I'd say the third thing that helped Twitter, the advantage that Facebook didn't have, is Facebook was really the first company like this to go public. A lot of Wall Street investors were skeptical, can companies like this really make money and grow? Now, Facebook has had about six quarters as a public company. Their stock, if you look at it now, is trading up around $50 a share. So it took Facebook quite a while to regain favor with investors. They've been seeing their mobile advertising revenues growing. And I think Twitter was able to kind of draft behind that a little bit. I think the street gets social networking and the advertising revenue model that companies like this have a little bit better than they did a year and a half ago.
They trust that even though Twitter is not making a profit, it will.
That seems to be the sentiment. I mean, I've spoken to lots of people who think that Twitter, I mean, it's funny, and because on the one hand, when a big IPO goes off like this, it's good news for us here in Silicon Valley. People get excited.
Right.
Other investors jump in. Mm-hmm. Lots of other companies get ready to go public. On the other hand, you kind of take a step back, and a lot of people will tell you that based on the fact that the company's not profitable and based on where its revenues are, there certainly seems to be some inflation in the stock. So maybe a lot of a good faith. And the thing to keep in mind for Twitter and its employees, those folks aren't going to be able to sell their stock for 6 months due to federal lockup periods. So it's anybody's guess. We've got a lot of, I reported last week that there are 1,600 new millionaires as a result of the Twitter IPO. 1,600. It's an open question as to whether 6 months from now all of those folks will still be millionaires. Maybe they will. It's always tough to predict.
I wanted to go back to something you mentioned earlier, because I wasn't aware that Twitter did opened up to its in institutional investors the day before. Facebook did the same thing, but the difference is that Twitter then expanded its offering?
No, the Facebook is the one that expanded the offering.
Gotcha.
Facebook, they both went out before an IPO, and the 2 weeks before an IPO, a company and its investment bankers will go out to what's called a roadshow, and they'll meet with the big institutional investors, they'll meet with the Fidelities, they'll meet with the pension funds, and they'll basically say, we're selling this many shares, how many would you like? And based on those discussions, they have a pretty good idea before they price their IPO as to how strong the demand is going to be. Both of these companies apparently saw really strong demand. What Facebook did that a lot of people in retrospect consider to have been an error was to say, we're going to sell more of the shares because we can.
Okay.
And keep in mind, too, Facebook was really criticized here in the Valley and in a lot of other places for not having a successful IPO. The counterargument to that is that the main goal of an IPO is to raise money for the company. And Facebook raised billions of dollars.
Right.
Facebook raised $16 billion in their IPO, the largest ever, by a wide margin. Twitter raised about $2 billion, and that was the second largest. So you can see the difference in scale between Facebook at number one and Twitter at number two. You will find people who will tell you that an IPO like Twitter's that has a huge one-day run-up actually is something of a failure because it means that the company could have sold their shares for more than they did. The company could have made more money.
Hmm. So what happens now? I mean, could it be the reverse? Could the reverse happen? Could they do a nosedive in coming weeks, in coming months, whereas Facebook has done this gradual, steady increase in the cost per share? Is there any danger with a 73% spike in the first day?
Sure. I mean, you know, any stock can go up or down for any reason, logical or illogical. The next really big milestone for Twitter is going to be in a few months when they report their first quarterly numbers as a public company. Wall Street's going to be paying a lot of attention, not only to what they did in the quarter in terms of revenue growth, but what kind of guidance Dick Costolo is going to give them, the CEO, going forward. And I think, I suspect that if, especially if the stock is trading anywhere near where it's been trading, that there'll be a lot of people on Wall Street listening for any signs of softening growth. Keep in mind that even before Twitter went public, once they filed their regulatory documents, a lot of critics looked. It was the first time anybody got a look at their numbers. And although they grew revenue tremendously,
yes,
year over year, expenses also grew up quite a bit, went up quite a bit because they're investing a lot in new people. They've gone from about 600 to about more than 2,000 people in the past year and a half. But perhaps, and Costolo has said that you're planning to continue to spend and grow the company, add new products. The other thing that people know to pay attention to, and this was true when Facebook went public as well, when these companies, they have such incredibly rapid growth in the early days, well, over time, that starts to slow. So Twitter was noting in their S-1s, in their regulatory documents with the SEC, that their user growth rate was slowing. I think people will be paying a lot of attention to that. So that quarterly report is going to be the next big event for Twitter, where people will be looking to see do they still believe in the stock or not. But the other thing is, but there's not any reason that the street, you know, people, it wouldn't surprise me one way or the other if the price were to fluctuate up or down before then. It doesn't necessarily take a lot for people to gain confidence in a stock or lose faith in a stock.
Talk a little bit more about the impact on Silicon Valley and when something like this happens. I mean, when Facebook, as you said, you used to face planted or knee capped, what happened in the Valley? I mean, what were people worried? Did they start, you know, renegotiating the mortgages on their houses or something? We have 1,600 new millionaires. Is the housing market going to expand?
Yeah, the housing market here seems sure to keep going crazy. In fact, even before Facebook went public, we saw a run up in housing prices here. People were trying to sort of preemptively get out and say, "I got to buy a house before all these Facebook millionaires start flooding the market." And I expect we'll see that too. When Facebook came out and just really got sort of smacked down by Wall Street, a lot of tech investors out here started saying, "Well, I'm not going to be doing consumer social anymore." So I know a lot of startup CEOs who suddenly couldn't find money from investors for that next round, private investors, because when companies are first getting off the ground, they need money from angel investors and then from venture capitalists. And that's how companies sort of bridge the gap while they're growing until perhaps they reach a point 5 or 6 down the road where they're able to go public. So I know a lot of startup CEOs who a year ago were being told, "Sorry, we're not going to put any more money into consumer social." And some of those companies, a lot of those companies, had to switch directions. I suspect that we will start seeing much more enthusiasm for consumer technology. We've got a couple more consumer IPOs this week. In fact, a company out here in Silicon Valley called Chegg, which does online textbook rentals for college students. A company in Seattle called Zulily, which is a marketplace for moms and kids. They sell kids' clothing in an online subscription model.
Right.
If those do well, especially, I think we'll start seeing even more enthusiasm for consumer startups, and that kind of broadens the base of the ecosystem, to use a word that people throw around here. I would hear a lot. Other impacts on Silicon Valley. So I think we'll see more companies getting started. I think as these new Twitter millionaires start being able to cash out, they're going to start investing in new startups. Mm-hmm. If you've heard about the PayPal mafia, PayPal went public and then sold to eBay. A lot of people made a lot of money, and then they put money into new companies like Facebook and Yelp and Tesla, on and on. There's lots and lots of companies out here in Silicon Valley that were seeded by PayPal millionaires, and there are companies now that are being seeded by Google millionaires and Facebook millionaires. Twitter's going to add to that as well. I'd say one final effect that's going to have out here in Silicon Valley is traffic. Traffic is just getting worse and worse. when things kind of cratered after 2007, 2008, yeah, the highways got a lot more navigable. And now we're definitely, even before Twitter's IPO, we're definitely seeing one of the penalties for the economic recovery, at least here in Silicon Valley, is people are spending a lot more time in their cars trying to get from A to B.
Well, it'll keep you busy, I imagine, right?
Absolutely. No, when the market, I've been in Silicon Valley since the dot-com bubble, and so I can tell you that a bull market like this is a lot more fun to cover as a journalist. There's a lot of optimism and enthusiasm and fortunes being made and people off to change the world, and that's always exciting.
All right. Well, Peter Delavette, thanks for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you so very much.
Peter Delavette, tech reporter for San Jose Mercury News. Hope you have some fun. Coming up, more Tech Tuesday, so stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. With Thanksgiving and the holiday season just around the corner, many families will be traveling a lot. That makes it a great time to load up on new apps that will keep the kids entertained in the back seat. Joining us now by phone to tell us about some of the best new apps for kids is Warren Buchleitner. He's editor of the Children's Technology Review. Welcome back to the show.
It's good to be with you, Ann.
And for our listeners, if you have some ideas about apps for kids in your life, want to tell us about them, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Warren, let's start with preschoolers. One game that got a very high rating is Bugs and Buttons 2. You like it even better than the first one.
Yeah, actually, I like the first one a lot as well. But they're just more games. Another collection of bug-infested activities that self-level, so that, you know, one of the things I like about it specifically is that they all start easy, and the better you do, the more competence you get, the harder the challenge.
So what do you do with Bugs and Buttons too?
These are all logic and sorting activities. You know, they go beyond the typical colors, shapes, letters you start noticing finer attributes. So and also the time increases. It's the kind of app that you walk away with in your head's going, "Oh wow, I can't believe," you know that you've been really thinking and concentrating.
Even if you're an adult.
Even if you're an adult, yeah. And it's a gorgeous app. I mean, the bugs look like, it looks so real. I'm looking at it right now. I see this ladybug with this like glisten. There's this game that's kind of like Angry Birds in a sense, that where you use a rubber band, you hold your two fingers out and you bounce the bugs off a target. There's a lot of sort of innovative game mechanics, and I love to find apps like this.
And kids love bugs.
And you know the basic theme. I mean, I'm bees, so. That gets your interest.
Now, go back to the better leveling issue. Why is that a problem? Is that something specific that you look for in games for kids?
Yeah, I mean, the challenge is something that's always the hardest part. You can tell good designers because they understand kids. Children, as we all know, vary greatly in their abilities. And even if you take a group of 4 or 5 year olds. Or just 5 year olds specifically on the first day of kindergarten, we know that they change incredibly and they vary incredibly. And so apps need, you know, any kind of game or toy should be able to accept children at whatever level they're at, but then somehow figure out how to challenge them. And that's the art, that's a sign of a master teacher, it's a sign of a master app designer.
Your review also mentioned the use of multi-touch that allows more than one child to use the app. We've talked about it before. They can solve puzzles together and that sort of thing. And have you seen kids working on an iPad, or any tablet together at once? Does it work really that well?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, it's great. Anytime, you know, you're talking about a long trip coming up, if you've got two kids in the back of a van where they're contained, they can play together. And so there's several ways of socialization and screens. One is turn-based. The other is sort of simultaneous. We work together. And this particular activity lets you both work together to sort as fast as you can. So they're called huddle games. We talked about them before, mm-hmm. but very good technique.
Another game for young kids is Daniel Tiger's Day and Night. Who's Daniel
yep.
Tiger?
What's that?
Who is Daniel Tiger? Is that the character?
That's the big question that PBS has been thinking about. It's the successor to Mr. Rogers.
Oh, really?
Yeah, this is a big, these are big shoes.
What do I know? Yeah.
A big sweater to fill. It's actually the son of one of the puppets.
Okay.
Right? So
right.
If you ever watched Mr. Rogers,
yeah.
Remember Daniel Tiger, this is his son, I think. I may be getting it wrong, but it's a kid, and he has a red sweater that with just like Mr. Rogers. This is the second app, and the reason it's important for us to talk about it is it's a good app. It's well designed. The first one was less. I didn't like it as well. It didn't pull kids in as much as it could. The second one is much better. You get to do things like try on different outfits, and you actually do you play a more active role in the play. So it's very good for younger children.
It's a big theme in Daniel Tiger's Day and Night is the idea of routine and how you get ready for the day and how you get ready for the night.
Yeah, and another great thing is in any kind of toy or play activity is that what are the hooks that to a child's real world? This is full of them. I mean, it's brushing teeth. You actually get to brush Daniel's teeth by moving your finger across his mouth and the foam comes up and everything. And the harder you brush, the more foam you get, just like in the real world. And this kind of an experience gives you the ability to talk about with your child, you know, the safe context to sort of talk about, you know, how long should you brush your teeth? And, you know, what do you do after you brush your teeth and that kind of thing?
And why can't you pick up your room yourself in the real life?
Exactly.
Your review describes this app as a big install, which means it takes up a lot of hard drive space. How big of a concern is that for parents?
Just something you should be aware of these days because, the lower cost iOS devices, the Apple devices, have 16 gigs. And if you've got an app that takes close to a gigabyte, that's 1/16 of the memory. You'll know when you start running out, and you mm-hmm. can manage those things. And the other thing people forget is you always keep a copy of the app in the cloud. So you can start, as you fill up your space, you can start swapping out activities.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about children's apps with my guest, Warren Buchleitner. He's the editor of the Children's Technology Review. If you have a question or comment about a children's app, you're welcome to give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Let's move on to some math apps. One math app that made your list was Motion Math Match. And there was another one, Quick Math, but in both, they're math. There's not a lot of doesn't look to be a lot of fancy graphics or anything.
Right. And you'd think, boring. The thing about, one constant that every child has to face is you got to learn your times tables and math facts. And so the question is, how can you use the multi-touch screen to make this age-old task more fun? And so these two apps that you mentioned, there's Motion Math and there's Quick Math, do it in a new way. And Motion Math does it in a way so that you actually can drag and drop the sums, sort of like you see a concentration like grid, and you have to match, you have to find the answers as fast as you can. And so let's say it's, the answer is 4, there might be 2 squares with the numeral 2 on them. So you can make a 4 really quickly by either tapping them both at the same time to add them up. So you're actually doing this math in your head, and in the iPad knows if you're touching the 2 and the 2 to equal 4, and if you get it right, it goes ding, and you get, and it makes you feel sort of empowered. You can also actually drag the tiles onto one another and add them up to make the answer. So there's multiple ways. This is the kind of thing where several kids could play at the same time, or a mom or a dad could play with their child and make it into more of a game. I just love to see sort of these tasks that used to be, flashcards brought into something that's engaging and more real, and I think that's great.
And then with Quick Math, it's Quick Math Plus?
Yeah, Quick Math Plus, you actually draw on the screen. So you're saying, okay, I could do that with a pen and pencil, so what's the big deal?
Because it's a screen.
It's a screen that can see if you did it right. So
okay.
So the one I always demonstrate is there's greater and less than, and you just see two sets of equations coming down, and, you'll see 8 on one side and, a math equation on the other side, and you just do a greater than or less than. You swipe the screen to make that symbol, and the computer, the iPad knows immediately if you got it right or wrong. So, and it's all about speed. Both of these are, you know, you are rewarded for speed and accuracy. And so it's great. Good stuff.
How does it work? Is it always positive reinforcement? How does the, when you get something wrong, how important is it with apps? I guess for particularly with younger children or older children in general, when you get the answer wrong, how does the app respond and how important is that?
Yeah, again, it's like if the masters are designing it, they know how to handle that. It's the thing that kids want the most is to speed along. You know, they want to get to the next level, and so waiting is definitely a four-letter word to a young child. And you want to make it so that if you make a wrong answer, it slows you down, and right answers quickly speed you to the next challenge and keep you moving. And so that's what you want. But every app does this differently, and some do it very well and others do it not so well.
Now, Quick Math Plus, it seems like it's geared more for the classroom than something a parent might purchase. Is that the case, or could it be just as much, just as useful for a parent to get it?
You could use it for anybody, really. I mean, it's $2, and okay. The challenge is there for you and me. We'd have quite a challenge with it just to practice our math facts. It goes up to logic and estimation. There's some pretty big numbers there. I know I had to think, and also with the swapping ability to quickly add on the spot. Yeah, it's definitely got some challenge to it.
And what makes an app work well in a classroom setting? They have to be using them in some schools, and you just know they're going to be doing tablets in schools. It's going to become more of a norm, we hope.
Of course, yeah, and I think it is. I'm sure that, I'd love to hear from some listeners about this, because, this is the first school year, really, where tablets are really starting to come into classrooms and in all levels. And apps like this, now I look for apps that sort of work as a standalone activity. So the metaphor is like it's a tub of materials that you just give a child and it'll work on its own. So far, every app we've discussed would work that way. Teachers are very interested in sound control if they don't have headphones. The feature we talked about with multi-touch, so that group, more than one child can play at the same time, is very classroom, helpful. And all of these things will supplement an existing curriculum. So it doesn't replace, it's just another way for a teacher to present a concept.
And when I said I hope, what I meant was you just hope that it's just not for certain kids get them because their parents can afford them. You hope that there's some
exactly.
parity. There's parity down the line.
Yes.
Tell us about the Toto Telling Time app. I actually remember the day I learned to tell time when it finally sunk in, but because that's back way in the olden days. In a wooden floored school.
Oh, really? Are
yes.
Are we that old?
We are that old. McKinley Grade School in Appleton, Wisconsin.
Okay.
But yeah, I remember Mrs. Rathbun. I didn't like her, but she did teach me in the second grade to read a clock. So tell us about Toto Telling Time.
Well, this one it is a new time. It's a new age. Reading a clock, either analog with the hands or digital, is a hard job. It's the kind of thing that we all have to figure out because someday we'll have to catch a flight. So this does it because it ties it in with the time of day in terms of lighting. So you can see at 9 or at 7 or 6 or whenever it starts to get dark. I don't know if this is a daylight savings time friendly app, but these activities. There's other things such as ordering the days of the week or the months of the year in a way that they're like tiles. And if you don't get it right, it just drops out and you get to try again. And this is sort of a general approach to all time units of time, so which I haven't seen in a lot of apps. So it's not just reading clocks.
Okay.
It's about reading calendars. It's about knowing the days of the week. And I was very happy to discover this app. The only downside is it's $4, but well
worth it. $4. You know, the way we talk about expense is funny. You know, someone did ask whether or not most of these apps cost money. Are any of them free? Or are they just these nominal amounts, $2 and $4 and that kind of thing?
Yeah. You know, and this is my soapbox that app designers who are making good products without commercial links, or, you know, they're treating this sacred space for the child, should be rewarded. And you know, I hope that people will, you know, pony up the $4 instead of buying a large latte, and buy a great app. And I think that publishers who are making quality apps and charging, you know, $2 to $4 for it are starting to build trust, and, you know, hopefully that'll start happening more.
We have just a little bit of time left, but I did want to talk about the Human Body app. It's a science app, and it looked really interesting.
Oh, download it right away.
Okay. Just, even for me?
Yeah. just download this app. It's so amazing. It, you know, just one of the things it does is that it turns your iPad into a giant eyeball, and the camera is you and I could, you know, try to explain how a retina works. That's pretty abstract stuff. I mean, the lens flips the image upside down. There's all of these parts and all of that. If you have a child who's interested in anatomy, and what child isn't, right? I mean, we all have bodies, and, you know, we wonder about things. This app shows them how it works without any concern. There's no embarrassment. It's totally driven by the questions children ask, like what happens when you take a bite of food, what happens to that food. You can trace it right through your body. It's just a phenomenal app, and it's the first app out of a small studio. It's a startup out of New York City. It absolutely floored us and when we found it. And
there have to be other apps though that deal with human body, right? I can't imagine.
There's a lot. There's a lot of them. You know, just type that into iTunes. What you'll find is, though, that this one is one of the few that flips the whole thing upside down and starts with the children's questions.
Okay. And it's called the Human Body. Hasn't someone stolen that name yet?
You know, I would think that's. Can we do a little bit better than that in the name? But that's what it does. It really. It's true to what it does. So yeah, definitely check out that app. It's incredible.
How do you know whether kids are going to like these apps as much as you do? How do you make those judgments?
Well, I happen to be 12 years old, according to my what my wife tells me. You know, looking at a lot of apps helps, and you know, I can pick up kind of what things tend to work or what doesn't work. The other thing is I have to watch a lot of kids, and the children are always teaching me things. And I have a center in our library where I go and watch children use apps. You know, I'm always keeping my eyes open. A lot of the apps that I've heard about, I hear about from actual kids.
Well, I think you must have the coolest job, one of the coolest jobs around. So thanks for sharing your insights with us once again, Warren.
Well, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, Ann.
Warren Buchleitner, he is the editor of the Children's Technology Review. Coming up, Russell Holly, tech blogger for Geek.com. We'll be right back. This is Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Google Glass, the smart computer you can wear on your head, has gotten a lot of buzz, but it is still not available to the general public. Google has only released the product to a select few, and I'm not one of them, as they work out the kinks and make improvements. Joining us to tell us how the process is going and other gadget news is Geek.com tech blogger Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Hey, thanks.
You know, why don't they give things like Google Glass to people like me who really could test it out?
Well, they certainly will within the next month or two, really. They're actually expanding the Explorer program to include as many people as are willing to sign up for it. But unfortunately, everyone who's testing it right now, they're not testing it for free. So I'm sure they'd be happy to give you one. It's whether or not you've got that $1,500 sitting around.
Oh, minor detail. Okay. So, all right. So first of all, remind us what Google Glass is and why it's taking so dang long to make it available to the masses, to the little people.
Sure. I've actually, I actually had to look back to make sure, but this is actually, I've been using Google Glass for 6 months now. And it is a small wearable computer that is roughly the same weight as a pair of normal glasses, and it sits on your face as though it is a pair of glasses, although there are no lenses. There is a tiny prism on one side that creates a transparent display just above where your eye would normally sit. So it's just out of sight. You glance up at it when you need it for things. I use it mostly for GPS navigation and for emails and text messages and kind of small things like that. But it has been every single month Google has released a software update to the Explorer program to make it more useful, to add more features, to extend battery life. And really, the reason that it has taken so long to finish is because they've been, you know, basing the experience that everyone has had in this program on what they should do next. They've been using that information to kind of build their roadmap. And so, you know, this was a whole new thing where it's all out in the open, it's all public, but it's the same basic development track that most, you know, smartphones and computers go through when they develop new features. So the only thing that's weird about this is that it's all being done publicly. But I think that that's actually been kind of exciting.
Yeah, I think it's kind of cool, too. What are some of the improvements you've seen over the last 6 months that impressed you?
Well, so there have been a couple. The first, and this was actually something that just happened within the last 48 hours, was a built-in music player tied into Google Music with a pair of headphones that you can plug in. If you want to, listen to music, it keeps everything kind of up around the head. You don't have to worry about, you know, cords running down your shirt or, you know, across your hoodie or anything like that. And it's been kind of cool. But there have been a lot of app integration with things like CNN and services that are similar to that can display news, not just in text, but also in video. Video is not something that was initially available. You can really grab a ton of different information from text messages to tweets, and a lot of this stuff was you know very very basic when it first started out, where you just got the text that floated up. But now there's very nice images and a lot friendlier user interface. Just you know kind of an all around. It's been this weird progression of small improvements that have built up to a whole different experience than what it was when I first used it 6 months ago.
Now, are you still shaking your head, or what do you use your hands? How do you operate it?
So most of it is voice driven, but the initial wake up for when you go to give voice commands can either be activated by lifting your head up a certain degree or tapping the touch panel on the side.
Okay.
And it has a whole touch panel that goes across the side. And there's that funny, I think it was Saturday Night Live sketch where the guy was jerking his head up every 30 seconds.
That's pretty funny.
That wasn't something that I ever experienced myself, but it has a direction sensor in it. And you can set it to a certain degree. So like if I lift my chin up 30 degrees, then it'll wake the sensor and it'll, you know, turn the computer on. And that's what that was in reference to. So, I mean, you can set it really low. But the problem that I found when I set it really low is like if I'm driving and like I hit a bump in the road, then it'll wake the sensor up because it thinks that I've lifted my head like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I end up leaving it at either 25 degrees or 30 degrees.
And when you talk about using it as a GPS while you're driving, you have it on and it shows you the road you're on and tells you where to go?
Yeah, think about like Google Nav
yeah.
For the iPhone and for Android, that turn-by-turn navigation service. It takes that and puts it on the display, and because it's a transparent display, it really looks like the image is on my windshield. I never have to look over at my GPS or look down at my phone or, you know, mess around with anything. It's right there, but it's not always there. It only wakes up and gives me the next set of directions when I've reached a certain point in the road. You know, so it'll tell me when I take a turn that, you know, my next turn is in 3.5 miles. And then when I get to the 3 mile mark, it'll wake back up and say, OK, this is what you need to do next.
It'll automatically wake up on its own.
It'll automatically wake up on its own as long as it's, you know, as long as the GPS service is on, then it'll do that. It ties to my phone and grabs the information from my phone. So it's mm-hmm. just as accurate as my smartphone as far as giving me GPS instructions. And, you know, I keep both hands on the road. I don't ever have to mess with anything. It's been really convenient. That is by far my favorite feature.
And it works as well at night as it does during the day, or can the sun glare affect it or what?
So it's kind of weird. Think of the glass prism has the same coating on it as those transitions lenses.
Yeah, I got them.
So when it gets bright, the lens itself will darken. And so that works. And to make things a little different, this was something that was a problem when they originally started, and it's not now. The camera acts as a light sensor and will adjust based on the ambient light in the area. When I first started using this, it was really hard to use at night because the display would turn on at kind of full blast. And so I'd get the full brightness of the display, you know, when it was really dark, and that, you know, I couldn't drive with that on because that was too much light.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's very, very dim. It matches whatever the ambient light is in the area, and it's much nicer to use in those environments.
Google is adding an earbud. Why was that needed?
So it has what's called a bone conduction sensor, and this was a little disconcerting for some people because the idea is that it's taking the sound and quite literally vibrating it into your head through the mastoid process just above your ear. And that works really well if you are by yourself or if you're in a car with the windows up. But when you go to a large crowded area like a mall, or you have the windows down in your car, then hearing things like turn-by-turn directions or even a phone call became difficult with that sensor, especially if you had enough hair that it was in between the sensor and your skin. So they've released this mono earbud that will be included with future versions of the hardware that you just plug in, and it just, you know, takes up the one ear and sounds significantly better.
I don't think I've ever seen anybody with Google Glass. Do you go in public with it?
Yeah, I rarely leave the house with it on.
You rarely do?
Mm-hmm.
Have people asked you about it when you're out and about with it, the rare times you are?
I got asked about it a lot a couple of months ago, but a lot of the you know, kind of my local area, especially my family, have all adjusted to it.
You mean you in it?
Yeah.
Are they going to change the design of the glass, do you think, what it looks like on your head?
Google has a couple of patents for different designs, but they haven't said that specifically that they're going to use any one of them for future versions. What they have said is that they are working with lens manufacturers, or rather frame manufacturers, for attachments for prescription lenses. And that's something that I'm really interested in as someone who also wears glasses, being able to just have one thing on my face instead of two. So that's something that, you know, will be something that, you know, it has that metal band that goes across and kind of connects at your nose bridge. And that whole piece is actually removable. So they are going to have lens frames that will clip in where that band is removable. And I think that that'll be a whole lot better for people like me.
Yeah, me too. Me and $1,500. So Microsoft is going to stop support of Windows XP. What does this mean? And do I have to worry about it?
Well, I mean, if you're using Windows XP, then you should certainly be concerned about it because, you know, a lot of the other virus definition manufacturers have stopped supporting Windows XP as well. Basically, what this means, the Microsoft Security Essential Suite, which is something that Microsoft a couple of years ago started providing for free to all of their users, would normally update with virus definitions once every couple of days and you know, perform scans and act like virus software, just not, you know, like top of the line virus software that you would, you know, spend, $70 a year for or something like that. So this has been something that has been a really good part of Windows for a couple of years now. It's been a really productive tool, but as of April 8th, they are no longer going to be supporting Windows XP. So if you're still using Windows XP and you're regularly connected to the internet, that's something that is going to be a problem for you. Really, you should stop using Windows XP.
Yeah. How many people do you think are out there hanging on to it for dear life? Do we know?
I think that it's a lot of people who have computers that either haven't been updated in a while or, you know, they've been looking at maybe replacing their computer. I don't know that there's a ton of people out there who are intentionally saying, well, I refuse to use Windows 7, you know, I refuse to use Windows 8. I think it's just, you know, spending the money on the new version of Windows is often, you know, a lot of money. And in some cases, especially now, it ends up being, you know, a third of the money that you would spend toward the whole new computer. So it's hard to say one way or the other. But I think that especially in corporate environments for kind of really basic data entry machines, there are still a lot of Windows XP machines out there.
Okay. You want, now this is, to me, this is not tech, but we're going to talk about it anyways because you wanted to talk about it. You always talk about what I want to talk about. Glow-in-the-dark ice cream?
This is absolutely technology. This is the best kind of technology.
Have you tasted it?
I have not, but okay. I have.
Who can afford to?
I have reached out to the people, and I'm really hoping that the next time I'm in that area, that I can go and do that. There is an ice cream company that has they do all kinds of, you know, crazy fun stuff, and they are called Lick Me, I'm Delicious. You know, just kind of a silly name, and they're, you know, very, kind of silly group. But they started doing some research not long ago into synthetic jellyfish proteins, because there are some jellyfish that can glow in the dark.
Mm-hmm.
They have this luminescence protein, and there was a Chinese scientist that synthesized that protein. And he bought a bunch of this synthetic protein and started testing it with different kinds of ice cream, and in the end came up with this ice cream that looks like completely normal ice cream when it's sitting in the cone, but then when you lick it, it starts glowing in the dark because it's calcium activated. So you'll have this kind of normal scoop of ice cream. But if you're walking around in the dark and you lick it, it will start glowing green.
Okay, so it's your tongue activates it.
Yeah, well, anytime, you know, it's calcium activated. So when you agitate it, then it'll start glowing. So I mean, technically, if you stirred it up really fast, if it was like in a bowl or something, then it would do the same.
It's expensive.
Very expensive. It is $225 a scoop because the protein itself is incredibly expensive to get a hold of because there's really only a couple of suppliers, and it's really meant for science labs. It's not really meant for food. So it's this kind of strange thing that's happening right now, but it does create this kind of whole new environment. Cause I mean, we've had, you know, weird kind of glow in the dark candies and stuff and toys, especially as kids. And this kind of takes it to a much safer, a much more organic level with this synthetic protein. And I think that that's really interesting.
Well, if you ever get a chance to taste it, I want to know what it tastes like at least.
I will absolutely report back to anyone who would listen if I end up getting a scoop of this ice cream.
All right. We just have about a minute, but you've seen the iPad with Retina display. It's available today.
Yep, iPad with Retina display is available today. It's $399 for the base model, which is 16 gigabyte Wi-Fi only, and the price goes up in $100 increments from there based on what you want to bolt onto it, like extra size, storage rather, or LTE capabilities. One of the really interesting things about this particular tablet launch is if you take them to T-Mobile, T-Mobile actually has a plan, regardless of whether or not you are a current subscriber, you actually get 200 megabytes of data for free. For any LTE-enabled tablet, and that is a perfect idea for an iPad mini because most people end up using them for kind of games and kind of basic content consumption. And so if you're not really set on spending that monthly amount for a data plan, then it's a cool way to do that.
Okay. All right. Well, Russell Holly, once again, thanks for joining us. Look forward to talking with you next week.
Thanks for having me.
Russell Holly, he's a tech blogger for Geek.com. Thanks for listening to Tech Tuesday today on All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.